In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Why, yes, indeed. Let us talk movies. It's Pass the Popcorn, Alan Adams of The Main Edge with us. Happy Monday to you, Mr. Adams.
And to you as well, Mr. Kimball.
How was your weekend?
Oh, it was okay. Yeah, it was all right. Beautiful weather. That's always nice.
Yeah, we like that. The sunshine, the warm temperature is good. Have you moved to shorts for the duration?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, you're gonna have to wrestle pants onto me before anytime before Halloween, I think.
Wow, Halloween, that's good. That's impressive.
Yeah, no, I go hard. That's how I do.
And that's why we love you and respect you, which may be more important than the love.
Indeed, yes, indeed. How about you? How was your weekend?
It was good. Yeah, same thing. Spent a lot of it outside. I was just telling Carrie that I got a few black fly bites along the way, and I actually saw, although I don't think it got me, but I saw a freaking mosquito yesterday.
Oh, yes, I had heard, I don't remember who it was, but I overheard someone saying that they actually saw a couple yesterday, and it was just like, okay, yeah, no, I guess it's early, but I mean, everything's warmed up so quickly.
Yeah.
I suppose it makes sense, so. Well, buckle in. It's only 4 months or so until they go away again.
Right. And then the snow's back and we start it all again. Well, in the meantime, how many movies did you get to see since last we chatted?
I got to see three.
Ooh. Well, tell us more.
Three movies. Well, we've got The Woman in the Window, the thriller starring Amy Adams. We've got Those Who Wish Me Dead with Angelina Jolie as a smoke-jumping firefighter. And then we've got Spiral, the latest installment in the somehow still ongoing Saw series. What would you like to talk about first?
Oh, dear. Well, because I'm not a fan of the torture porn, so let's do that one. Let's do, is it Spiral? And dispense with that quickly.
Yeah. Yes, Spiral, as it is, it's also known as Spiral from the Book of Saw. I don't need to ask you this question because I know your answer. I feel like mine is pretty similar. But did we really need another Saw movie?
No. Could have said that 20 years ago.
But I mean, again, it should be a surprise. Like, I mean, like the landscape is just littered with sequels and reboots and franchises and. Considering, the horror genre remains one of the few sort of generally reliable, box office draws, and, it makes sense that we're seeing something like this kick off, particularly when we're in the midst of sort of a wider, what appears to be a wider reopening of movie theaters. But, look, these movies have been, this is the ninth one, by the way. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Wow.
One through seven. And then they did a sort of prequel reboot-y type thing with a movie called Jigsaw a couple years ago, and then now we have this one, which is it's more of a continuation of the story, I guess. But even that one that came out a couple years ago did nine figures at the box office.
Good Lord,
movies make money. So, but that being said, the sort of transgressive nature of the earlier installments, which is I think what was a large part of the draw, has kind of been backlined in favor of just sort of going bigger and gorier and whatnot. So I will say it was interesting in that watching this latest incarnation at least make an effort to try and say something beyond look at how gross this is. So it's basically the first spinoff. It's directed by a gentleman by the name of Darren Lynn Bozeman, who this is his fourth Saw movie. But it's a movie that has kind of some surprising star power because Chris Rock stars in this movie.
What?
It definitely is trying to use its sort of gory torture devices, which I will say are still effective, to say something about the wider world. In this particular case, it actually attempts to address questions of surrounding police corruption and by extension, the systemic racism that can come from that system. And again, look, you're not going to get a ton of nuanced commentary from a Saw movie. Like, no one's showing up here to get a lecture on world affairs. They want to see people die in terrible ways. But it's been a while since one of these movies felt like it was about anything rather than just an excuse for inventive torture. And in that case, I mean, it's not a particularly successful attempt, but, you know, points for trying, I guess, is where I land on it. Granted, it's well-intentioned. Execution leaves a lot to be desired. Some of the performances are pretty solid. Like, Chris Rock was actually quite good in this movie. But it's a scattered, haphazard kind of story, a lot of questionable decisions regarding pacing. And so it's, you know, it's a very gory horror movie that is never really able to articulate what it wants to convey. That being said, I also learned, on a personal level, my tolerance for this type of gore has been significantly lessened by my film watching of the last year. I used to review this type of movie more regularly, but it's been a while. And so the ick factor kind of crept up on me. Like, it gets a little intense, and I don't think I was properly prepared. So anyone out there who's listening who wants to go see that, you know, be warned. It gets gross. So Chris Rock plays Zeke Banks. He's a homicide detective. He's also a pariah within the department due to the fact that years ago he reported his then partner for being dirty. You know, and he's a legacy in policing. His dad, Marcus, played by Samuel L. Jackson, was a longtime like chief of the department, and so you know, he's got that kind of that double whammy working against him as far as the, you know, in the eyes of his colleagues. But one of their fellow officers gets killed in the subway tunnels, and it becomes clear that they may be dealing with a copycat of the legendary Jigsaw killer. Zeke gets a new partner, a guy named William Schenck, played by Max Minghella, this sort of idealistic rookie detective. Zeke doesn't want a new partner, but that's what he gets. And the two of them quickly find themselves drawn into this web of horror as the new killer, sporting a kind of on-the-nose pig mask, continues targeting police officers that have been in some way corrupt. For whatever reason, Zeke has been chosen as the point person, the recipient of the twisted clues to the games that are being played. But, you know, they follow these clues, and a whole lot of dangers, old and new, present themselves. Like, he's fighting not just this sort of mysterious killer, but all of these fellow officers who view him as untrustworthy, as a result of him doing the right thing. However, that still renders him sort of disloyal in their eyes. Look, the world's changed a lot since the first Saw movie came out, which was back in 2003. You know, that sort of... In torture porn, I think, is the proper terminology. You know, that sort of stuff has kind of fallen out of favor, supplanted by, like, the outgrowth of stuff like elevated horror, like the things like, you know, Hereditary and Midsommar and those sorts of horror movies. But there's something to be said for sticking with what you know. And what Saw knows is horrifically intricate Rube Goldbergian torture devices intended to punish the immoral among us. And, you know, in that respect, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I will say it's more instead of, you know, the narrative fitting around the edges of the gory horror set pieces, they try to flip that formula and let the narrative steer the ship and just sort of use the horror as sort of punctuation. Ultimately, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, and that undercuts the effectiveness of the narrative, as well as any sort of underlying message. Chris Rock's actually quite good here. He does a good job. It's a very different performance from what we've come to expect, although he can't help himself, and there are definitely some jokes in here. But he plays it mostly straight, and it works. But, yeah, it spirals a good-faith effort at expanding the Saw cinematic universe. And I get why they want to do it. This is a franchise with a ready-made audience, but... I mean, ultimately, the realization of it just doesn't quite measure up.
All right, that's Spiral. Let's see, where do we go? How about Angelina Jolie, Smoke Jumper?
So this is Those Who Wish Me Dead. And this is probably the movie I like the best of the three. I've developed a real taste in recent years for this sort of the evolution of the Western that we've seen in recent years, like the sort of quote-unquote neo-Western, you know, these movies that sort of maintain those those sensibilities of the classic, you know, 60s and 70s Westerns within a more present day framework. And I think probably the foremost practitioner of that particular style right now is Taylor Sheridan, who he's behind movies like Wind River, Hell or High Water, and he's the creator and showrunner for the TV show Yellowstone. And this is his latest. It's called Those Who Wish Me Dead. He directed and co-wrote the script. It's adapted from Michael Korch's 2014 novel of the same name. It's a great example of how that sort of neo-Western vibe doesn't necessarily rely on genre tropes. Like, there aren't any cowboys here, but the tone and the attitude of the characters and the narrative around them is really, you can really draw a straight line from this to, like, the Sergio Leone, like, that those sorts of movies, that sort of, those sort of anti-hero Westerns of the 60s and 70s. It's very lushly filmed, one that takes full advantage of, you know, the natural backdrop where it was filmed. It's filmed largely in Montana, I believe. Top-notch cast. Angelina Jolie leads off. But, again, it's one of those movies where there's an underlying lack of clarity to some of what goes on that kind of keep the movie from reaching its full potential. That being said, it's a hell of a watch. And honestly, most of the time, and certainly in this case, it's more than enough. So Angelina Jolie stars as a woman named Hannah. She's a Montana smoke jumper dealing with the emotional aftermath of this massive forest fire that resulted in a number of deaths, including three kids who were camping and one of her fellow firefighters. She blames herself for their deaths, and she was sort of scapegoated for mistakes that were made above her head. But all this means is that she's basically been shoved off to serve as a lookout at a nearby fire tower. Her friends are all concerned about her self-destructive behavior, including her ex-boyfriend, this deputy sheriff named Ethan, played by John Bernthal, who's excellent here. And everyone wants to help, but not sure how they can. So we meet her. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, in Florida, we see a forensic accountant by the name of Owen Casserly, played by Jake Weber. He's going on the run. He's got his young son, Connor, played by Finn Little. And apparently, Owen has uncovered some sort of undefined massive malfeasance involving a number of incredibly powerful people. So he and his son are in danger. Specifically, a pair of assassins, Jack and Patrick, played by Aidan Gillen and Nicholas Holt, who are basically targeting anyone who might reveal the truth behind whatever this is. He's trying to go into hiding, so Owen reaches out to his old friend, who happens to be the aforementioned Ethan Sawyer, as well as his wife, to hide out with them out in the Montana wilderness. Unfortunately, the assassins catch on to his plan, head out in pursuit. I'm not going to go into specifics. I don't want to spoil anything in particular. But I will say this pursuit ultimately leads to young Connor being left to fend for himself out in the woods, fearing for his life. And this is when he crosses paths with Hannah, who opts to do whatever she can to protect him and help him get his father's information to the media. But our relentless assassin duo of Jack and Patrick are also willing to do anything to prevent that from happening, up to and including murder, mayhem, and setting the entire GD forest on fire.
Oh, dear.
That's where we're at. Look, Those Who Wish Me Dead has a ton going for it. Tightly executed. It's lean in a way that you don't often see these days. More and more filmmakers seem to be erring on the side of length, like this attitude of better to have 20 minutes too many than 20 minutes too few. I think that's the rationale. But Taylor Sheridan gives us, I mean, it's a tight 99 minutes. Like, there's no fat here. To the point where I would argue that at certain points, a little more explication could be helpful. But Taylor Sheridan is on record as being vehemently anti-exposition. And so he makes that position very clear with how he's made this film. And so that absence does leave us with some holes regarding motivations. Like, we don't really know why people are doing what they're doing in some cases. It's not as big an issue as it might be, because Sheridan has this real knack for constant forward motion. Like, you're given this impression that there just isn't time for any of that. We just got to keep going forward. And it does sort of endow these brief flashes of backstory we get with more significance than I think they might otherwise carry. And it also means that there's more room for the action sequences. Like, the fire scenes are particularly intense. They do a great job of sort of eliciting that sense of fear and panic that could come from watching things burn on a large scale. You know, it was interesting to see Angelina Jolie back in the sort of action saddle. Like, she hasn't worked a ton in the past 10 years or so, and we certainly haven't seen her in a role like this in over a decade. And she's good here. Like, she has that. I mean, you know, she has that it. Like, she's always popped on screen, and that hasn't gone away. And she also developed a really wonderful connection with Finn Little, the young man playing Connor. And that connection is one of the best parts of the movie. Like, and the kid's really good. Like, he's clearly talented, no problem holding his own alongside some pretty significant heavyweights. Aidan Gillen and Nicholas Holt are fantastic together. Like, we get zero background on them. Like, we have no idea. Like, we're given no backstory, nothing. But they still manage to convey a layered relationship, even as they're single-minded in their goals, which is really great. You know, Bernthal's not quite as lucky. Like, his role's kind of flat, more of a plot device sort of oriented thing. But he's good. He's good at what he does. So it ultimately proves to be a really strong ensemble. Like, for me, this is a pretty good movie that just misses being more than that. Like, a solid thriller, some good performances, but a little lacking in terms of context and characterization. That said, that sort of Western film ethos rings pretty strong, and if you dig that, you'll probably dig this.
We're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge, and finally, an all-star cast. Do they pay off in The Woman in the Window?
Well, Rich, are you familiar with the term defenestration?
Yes.
The act of hurling oneself out a window?
Yes.
That's kind of how I felt after watching this movie.
Wow.
Look, movies don't always work. There are a million reasons why, potentially, but that's the truth. Sometimes films fail. And on the surface, something like The Woman in the Window, like, looks like a candidate for success. There's a ton of talent involved. Joe Wright is directing. He's very good. The cast is wildly overqualified, with Amy Adams leading the way. Based on a best-selling book, the adaptation is by Tracy Letts. You know, it's like all the pieces are there. But as soon as you look closer, it all starts to crumble. Like, this is a movie that was set to come out in the fall of 2019, nearly 2 years ago. Like, but they had terrible test screenings, which led to re-edits, which pushed the release to May of 2020. We all know how that worked out. And with that delay, the studio just up and sold the rights to Netflix, and here we are. And after sitting and watching it, like, the biggest question I have is, man, how bad was this movie before they fixed it? The whole woman in distress thriller has seen kind of a renaissance in recent years. Like, you know, something like Gone Girl, both Gillian Flynn's book and the excellent David Fincher movie. But this one just doesn't have that same energy. Amy Adams stars as Dr. Anna Fox. She's a child psychologist living alone in a Manhattan brownstone. She's separated from her husband, Edward, Anthony Mackie. He lives somewhere else with their daughter, but they speak daily. And she is an agoraphobic. She's psychologically unable to leave her home, although it does appear that she's making a little bit of progress through therapy. Her therapist is played by the aforementioned Tracy Letts in an uncredited appearance. Takes a lot of medicines, drinks too much, particularly due, you know, as far as, you know, mixing medications and alcohol, and spends a lot of her time in her very dimly lit living space, either watching classic movies or basically staring out the windows at her neighbors. And Rich, if you're going to ask me, oh, classic movies and staring out the windows at her neighbors, I don't suppose they make a reference to Rear Window. Literally watches the movie at one point.
Oh, dear God.
This is that kind of movie.
Oh.
We are very much on the nose here. Anyway, so a new family moves in across the street and is intrigued. The teenager, a kid named Ethan, played by Fred Hechinger, pays her a visit with a gift from his mom. Seems like a nice kid, a little troubled, drops some hints that his father, Alistair, played by Gary Oldman, might be a not so nice guy. Later, Ethan's mom, Jane, played by Julianne Moore, also pays a visit, and it's a nice night. They laugh, they have some wine, they play cards, all that. Just a few days afterward, Anna, who again has been peering through the Russells' windows from across the street, sees Jane being attacked and killed through the window. She calls the police, but when the detectives show up, one of whom, played by the excellent Brian Tyree Henry, they arrive, they have the Russell family with them. They have Alistair, they have Ethan, and they have the woman who everyone claims is actually Jane Russell, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And no one can corroborate what Anna saw or thought she saw. Not even the dude that she's renting the basement to, this kind of shady character named David, played by Wyatt Russell. So this is where we learn the truth behind Anna's separation from her husband, and it becomes very clear that the structure of her reality is fragile and easily cracked. Like, she's left to struggle with her tenuous connection to the world around her. And that being said, as you might anticipate, there is considerably more to the story, though I'm not sure if you'll ultimately really care. Look, it's a skewed perspective thriller whose thrills are kind of underwhelming. Like, the narrative really telegraphs a lot of its twists. Like, it's hard to find much of anything surprising about this as it plays out. And when your whole thing is built on a foundation of surprises that aren't surprising, it's just not going to work. Like, look, the film is oddly sedentary, and I know, like, you've got a single location, you know, an isolated protagonist, but we've seen a lot of movies where this sort of structural enclosure works. And again, it's very clear that Joe Wright has also seen these movies, because he is not subtle about making sure his influences are apparent. Like, as I mentioned, Jimmy Stewart moment from Rear Window, very on the nose. But again, it all just feels kind of static. You know, and a lot of deliberate stylistic choices that feel unnecessary. Like, Joe Wright's got a good eye. Like, we've seen it in some of his earlier work, but a lot of the aesthetic flourishes just read try hard. I get it. The story certainly needs help, despite the best efforts from Tracy Letts. But look, it's a great cast. Like, these are all very talented people, but nobody seems all that engaged with what's going on here. I appreciate Amy Adams, you know, her recent sort of efforts to take roles that seem to be aimed at letting her sort of show her jagged edges a little bit more. You know, she was great in Sharp Objects, less so in Hillbilly Elegy. But, she's at her best when she's allowed room for nuance, and there's not very much of that here. And everyone else is just kind of bored. Like, Gary Oldman, who again, like the last time he worked with Joe Wright, he won an Oscar. You know, Joe Wright directed The Darkest Hour. You know, but I've never seen him shallower or more surface level. Like, there was just nothing there. You know, and Julianne Moore and Jennifer Jason Leigh are just squandered. They don't get anything to do. Heckinger, the kid, is really going for it, but that comes with its own set of problems. And then you've got the rest of these wonderful actors, Anthony Mackie, Wyatt Russell, Brian Tyree Henry, and they're just kind of there. Like, there's no real sense of character or characterization. Again, and we come across these every once in a while. It's one of these films that is just far less than the sum of its parts. Like, with this kind of pedigree, like, it should have been good, or at least passable. But instead we get this, like, thrillless thriller that's all jagged and disconnected. Like, it's not even so bad it's good. It's just bad.
Well, there you go. Alan Adams summing it all up for us this afternoon with a trio of films. Thank you much, Al. We appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man.
Let's chat again on Wednesday if that works for you.
That sounds lovely to me.
All right, we'll do it then. Thank you, sir.